That was true, and I'm not a opponent of digital media, obviously. I think that platforms and digital media helped a lot to make music culture or culture more participatory. But they are getting so sneaky in appropriating what happens and branding it.
Lorenz Grunewald Shukala is talking about branding arenas in the music industry. Lorenz is a project manager at The Hig and himself a musician.
Somehow the perspective of playing in bars every night and there's a lot of drinking and it's late, it's a lot of driving, that didn't resonate so much with me.
In this episode of Exploring Digital Spheres, we talk about how big brands like Red Bull and Telecom are inserting themselves into music culture. By organizing music festivals, building high-tech music studios, these brands are not only presenting themselves in this culture, they are essentially shaping the way the music develops as well. Lorenz Grunewald Shukala has been researching this phenomenon, but first we talk a bit about how he ended up in the academic world. Here is our conversation.
Then there's of course then the moment that, oh, it was not entirely conscious, you decided to sort of engage with music in a different way, but then there is also the moment that you make a switch and think like, no, actually, this is what I want to do. This is, at this moment, a topic that I want to sort of really dive into.
Yeah, no, I don't think I work like that. It's more like sometimes some doors open and you see if you want to go through them or not. So staying on academia was because we did a bigger project on the music economy in Berlin when I was a master's student. It was together with the Berlin Music Commission, and it was very interesting. It was about how the usage of new digital media, it was like 10 years ago, right, changed how music corporations and also artists worked here in Berlin. And after we did that, my supervisor, he offered me the chance to do a PhD with him, and so I thought maybe I could try that for a couple of years. And got a post at a university here in Berlin as a research assistant and started the PhD.
What was your PhD about?
The PhD, I don't have it yet. I still have to finish. It's almost done, I can say. And it's no joke, it's really almost done. It's about the ways that the relationship between brands, like big corporate brands like Red Bull or the Telekom, interrelate with music, more especially the music industry or music economy and music culture, something that has been going on in history ever since there is a music industry. But now you can kind of see that there's a new quality now that digital platforms arrived, stuff is changing. You can also see that more and more money is being spent by brands to do something with music culture. And you can see that the involvement gets much deeper. So brands, they stay longer in music culture and they kind of build infrastructures on which music culture can happen.
You were saying ever since the music industry has been going on, there has been some influence by brands, etc. Like, what do we have to think about in terms of when the music industry becomes a thing, and what kind of influence are we talking about then?
So I'm a media and communication scholar. So for me, I start when print media arrived, and you can track kind of a music industry back to what they call the Tin Pan Alley, which was a street in the United States where a lot of sheet music publishers were. So the business model of the music industry back then was to create hit songs. They had songwriters working all the time creating new kind of Schlagermusik and printing sheet music for people to buy and take it home and play it on the pianos.
When is this?
This is around early 20th century, 1900. And you can see already back then that corporations, which were not brands at the time, because it was much more product-based what corporations did, they used these sheet music to place advertisement, for example. And there's a funny example of a company called Beecham. They had the Beecham's music portfolio. And it was like a catalog catalog of sheet music, which they would sell in pharmacies. or just leave there for people to take away. And Beecham's, they produced pills to make your to relieve your stomach after you had too much food or something like this. So,
but this seems relatively sort of harmless in a way, you know, with all the things that we now know. Printing a picture or a name on some sheet music doesn't necessarily change the infrastructure on how this music is produced.
No, not at that time. Probably. I mean, it's hard to get numbers on that time in a way to measure how much money came from these corporations to kind of see how important it was for the business model of the music industry back then. But it kind of evolved from there. So if you look at the 1930s and look at kind of white jazz music, then it becomes obvious that corporations and brands were becoming more important in kind of a structural view, because most of what you could hear in white jazz music on the radio was funded by tobacco companies like Camel. So all the shows were where the hosts and their bands would play, they would be called like Camel Caravan Show or something, and they would fund anything of it, all of it. So the whole thing was set up by a tobacco brand, and it was funded completely by an industry that is not originally in music. And the musicians and the hosts, they would smoke during the shows, and there's some really nice takeouts from on YouTube from these kind of shows, and they would say how awesome the cigarette is that they are actually smoking. So it's really funny. And then you can start to see that the advertising industries and corporations are becoming more important for the business models of the music industry.
I'd say that what you just described, this Camel Caravan Show, that sounds way more like what you were describing earlier about Red Bull organizing something. Could you maybe talk a little bit about comparing these two and how, for example, yeah, it is very similar, but maybe also what the differences are?
I mean, the differences are that it's much more is going on now. So if I can give you a couple of examples, the Telecom has a program called Electronic Beats, where they do lots of different activities in electronic music. So they have concert evenings, they have whole festivals which last for a couple of days that they completely host by themselves. They have a magazine on electronic music, which was a printing thing for some time. Now it's more block-based. They have kind of a newcomer program where they help young musicians, well, at least they say they help them. That's what they claim, to get heard, to get seen. I already mentioned the studios that Red Bull is building. Red Bull also, until last year, had the Red Bull Music Academy, which is kind of a big workshop program for DJs and people from avant-garde electronic music, where they fly them to cosmopolitan cities and have a whole kind of quarter in the city built for them to do gigs, to have studios, to workshop together, to talk to music icons that they invite, like Brian Eno, Erykah Badu. And that is surrounded by a whole network of events and festivals that Red Bull does internationally.
And Red Bull is doing this because?
Well, they're doing this for many reasons. And I look at that perspective from a communications perspective. And for me, it's about they're doing this to create some momentum for themselves in digital flows. So I call these kind of structures that they create, the festivals, the studios, the concerts, I call these kind of, they are brand arenas. And that comes from obviously Roman arenas, but also modern arenas like the Mercedes-Benz Arena you have at Ostbahnhof. And this is kind of a spatial structural metaphor to show that these structures are built by somebody for some purpose. They don't have control over anything that happens inside the arena, but they have some control. If you look at the Red Bull Studio, for example, it's so well made, so strategically made, that artists who go to the Red Bull Studio to record, I've done some participatory observations there, they are posting on Instagram all the time. They're using the Snapchat all the time. Every 15 minutes, they do something to give their fans, right? And it's almost not possible to take a picture inside there without not having a Red Bull logo behind you, having a Red Bull can on your DJ desk, whatever. They will even offer you very friendly Red Bull to drink all the time. So if you take all of that together and say that this are brand arenas, they kind of afford through their design that people are sharing stuff all the time, which becomes branded in the moment that a picture is created. And that way they kind of guarantee that they end up in digital flows where people share stuff and view stuff and comment stuff. And that's one of the things that I call momentum, because it's my hypothesis that at the core of these brand-related, these music-related brand strategies is that they want to create momentum, kind of a moving visibility for themselves.
The people that are on these in these festivals, the artists that are in these studios, are they not aware that they're part of this massive sort of branding structure?
They are very aware, yeah.
Do they care?
It's hard to say, because what people do and what they say is something different. When I go to festivals as a kind of an ethnographer doing observations, I'm talking about fans now, they will go there and enjoy themselves and like the music and drink their drink that they have to drink. And they won't talk much about brands being present. So if you start asking them about brands, then they will have an opinion about it, obviously. And they will say, oh, it's too much branding, it's not subtle enough, these kinds of things. So they will have an opinion, but it's not what they do. And you have to be reflective about this if you do ethnographic research, because if I start asking them, then it's kind of a researcher-induced discourse. So it's not easy to say if they care. You'd have to define more what care means. And there is an Australian researcher, his name is Nicholas Carra. He did something similar a while ago, and he used Marx and Zizek's notion of cynicism to kind of explain this, because he says that it's not like in Marx times where people were unaware that the world they live in was structured by economic interests. This is not the case anymore at these festivals. The brands are everywhere. You can see them. It's obvious that the thing you need to do music or to enjoy music is funded by brands, is made by brands. But it's hard to get out of that structure anyway. So in his opinion, people stay quiet or become cynical about this because they have to kind of talk about it in a normative way, but the way that they can act, they can change so much.
Now, one very important aspect is, of course, also what this whole strategy by these brands means for music in general. I mean, you say, yeah, they create these spaces, they create these experiences, people consume it. But it has also an impact on what music is being created, what music makes it to people. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, this term momentum that I try to develop, it's kind of twofold. So for the one thing, it's about these digital flows. They want to be shared, like a viral campaign. You know, back in the days you had viral campaigns and brands were hoping that people would share stuff a lot. It's not viral because it's not a virus where people do anything unconsciously. They choose to share. And today, if you have these brand arenas where it's so subtle and informed by the material base of these brand arenas, it's not kind of a viral campaign anymore, but it becomes part of all the music cultural practice. It gets harder to do anything else if you go to a festival than use your smartphone and do something for a brand. You can't escape it very much. And also, of course, fans and musicians as well need this momentum. And that's kind of the second dimension that I'm trying to sketch out. I think that through the brands, and we have to talk about digital platforms as well, these music fields, they become also reconfigured in a way that momentum gets more important. So now you will have a hard time as a musician if you're not visible online. Your kind of worth to work with a brand, certainly, but also to work with other players in the music industry, is more and more generated through your ability to create momentum. If you have a lot of followers, if you have a lot of visibility, if you can create content that people like and will share, then you become a more kind of respected member of the field, and your options to do something will increase. It's what Bourdieu called symbolic capital. So kind of from the outside, through platforms and brands, music fields as well get changed in a way.
Now, the brands would tell you or would tell us that what they're doing is for the greater good of our societies, that through their money, the money that they put in there, people get to see these stars, they get to develop themselves, they get to get unique content and beautiful music. Is that right?
Well, it's not wrong.
Where are we heading?
I mean, they certainly don't state that they're doing good for society, but the usual way they would say it's we are supporting musicians. We are giving musicians a platform. You know, these kinds of metaphors.
But I'd say that like that's... I can imagine them just saying, like, well, yeah, but like, of course we have these products and we make money from the products, but we also, you know, want to do something. We want to show our social responsibility and stuff like that. You know, I feel like they are putting it in this light of this is us giving back in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the way they try to sell it most of the time. But obviously you can see a power relation there very easily, because the ways that brands and platforms change these fields, it's not easy to get away from if you're a musician. If you're a musician that doesn't want to work with a brand, you're gonna have a hard time. And usually they accept it. They take the money. There's even called a term they use called Schmerzensgeld. I don't know if you would know how to translate that.
Yeah, very painful money.
Yeah, pain relief money. Which they use when they say the brand is so bad, or the thing that we have to do with them is so bad that it doesn't increase our reputation, but we take the pain relief money anyway. But most of the time, it's not about money. It is if they book an artist for a festival. But if you look at these studios or these festivals, or I myself, when we were with a band, we had a deal with Volkswagen and they gave us a tour bus just for a year. You know, and if you have these opportunities, you can do more stuff. If you have more money, you can do more stuff. So working with a brand increases your potential to do something in the field that you're in. And artists need that, and they can't really get out of it. There are not so many artists who do not work with brands.
Maybe I can ask you as a sort of a final question. You bring up this very interesting example of the Volkswagen bus.
Yeah.
So how do you see the sort of balance between, yeah, the support that you get, which is great especially if you're beginning, and even if you're probably at the top, you know, you're still getting the support of a venue, of a festival, and at the same time creating a sort of a nice power balance where artists can actually make whatever they want to make, and people can enjoy the music without having to snap a selfie with the brand in it.
Yeah, I mean, the power you have over a brand changes with how much momentum you already have. If you're Coldplay, which was one of the cases I looked at as well, you can dictate a lot to a brand. If you're a newcomer, not so much. But I'm not sure. I mean, this is important, obviously. What can you put in your contract if you work with a brand? How much power you have there? But I think that overall, this value or this category of momentum gets more important and gets employed by platforms and brand, and you can't escape that. So what you see is that it's getting harder to be an artist if you can create this kind of momentum, if you can't get people to post stuff about you and the brand you are working with. And this is kind of probably more abstract, but also more concerning thing, probably because it's getting harder to imagine different ways how music culture could work. You know, it's getting harder to find a space that is not branded.
But to me, it sounds so ridiculous in a way, because with our digital society and with platforms and with social media, it seems like there is a multitude of options now that you can bring yourself, way more than there were in the 1960s, for example. It, like, somehow it seems easier to circumvent brands now than it was in the 1960s when all the venues were owned by tobacco companies, for example.
Hmm. Yes, I think that was true, and I'm not a opponent of digital media, obviously. I think that platforms and digital media helped a lot to make music culture or culture more participatory. But they are getting so sneaky in appropriating what happens and branding it, which is why they do these arenas, which is why they use the material structures that we have to use to create branded content. And if you are at a festival and you don't use a brand hashtag or something, they have bots who can track that you were at the festival, and they will comment on your post with a branded hashtag. So it's not getting easier to evade it, I guess. There are examples of festivals like the Fusion Festival, where they really strategically say there are no brands allowed here. They even try, if they use televisions or projectors, to tape away the logos. But these spaces are decreasing.
That was Lorenz Grunewald-Tschukala. More on his research available in the notes of the show. And of course, if you want to know more about other research projects organized by the Humboldt Institute for Internet and Society, or visit one of the many events they are organizing, visit hiig.de. Ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed this episode, if you're 20 minutes wiser about the internet, don't forget to leave us a review or comment on iTunes. This was Exploring Digital Spheres. Catch you on the flip side.